This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Bronson from the Etc. Group has some important warnings about the rush to geoengineering. Diana, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, as you know, the so-called skeptical environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg, he's pushing a program of cloud ships to block out the sun and thus cool the earth. He says that will only cost $9 billion annually instead of the $250 billion it might cost to switch to a real zero-emissions economy. Does geoengineering sound like a good deal to you?
We're very concerned about geoengineering, and the sad thing is that there's voices that are a lot more credible than Bjorn Lomborg who are advancing these ideas right now.
Yeah, we've got the Royal Society with big names like James Lovelock and Lord Martin Rees. They've got a press release out August 28th, 2009, saying we've got to develop geoengineering as a plan B. I guess they figure we'll just keep on burning fossil fuels past the dangerous point. What can we say about this?
Well, there's a good deal to be said because it's not only a press release they put out, but a 100-page report written up by a group of quite eminent scientists, most of whom are actively engaged in geoengineering, in geoengineering research, I should say, and who are actively lobbying for experimentation on our world. So maybe we should just draw back for a minute and see what it encompasses, geoengineering, because frankly most people don't have any idea. It's a variety of technologies. I'd say there's about a dozen that are under active discussion. This includes things like shooting sulfates into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back so it doesn't actually reduce the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It merely reflects back the sunlight so you don't have the effect of global warming. It includes things like ocean fertilization, dumping iron particles or urea or various other particles into the ocean to try and stimulate the growth of algae, which also absorbs carbon dioxide and then theoretically would sink to the bottom of the ocean where the carbon dioxide, the excess carbon dioxide, would be safely stored. It includes things like giant carbon-sucking machines that would draw the carbon out of the air, either at the point at which it's emitted or subsequent to that. Cloud whitening you talked about, again, that's what's known as an albedo-enhancing technique, something to make the surface of the earth a bit whiter so that sunlight gets reflected back. But all of these schemes have potentially disastrous environmental and social consequences, and for that reason, the Etc. Group has been a pretty consistent voice in urging extreme caution while we look at these ideas, and we find some of the recommendations of the Royal Society report extremely dangerous.
You know, it seems like we want to trust the Royal Society, and yet I look to it. James Lovelock has said that as few as 8% of humanity would survive by 2100. He said that on The Hour, a CBC radio program. And Martin Rees has written a book in 2003, Final Warning, giving us just a 50-50 chance of surviving at all. I'm wondering, why this sudden rush to geoengineering, and can you explain that?
Well, I think, actually, to be fair, certainly Lovelock has written a number of very critical things about geoengineering, and neither him nor Martin Rees are men that are easily given into a quick technological fix. And, you know, James Lovelock at the press conference, probably rather unpredictably to the Royal Society, said that he found these schemes Kafkaesque, which isn't exactly a ringing endorsement of them. But I guess the biggest card that the geoengineering lobby has in its pocket is this need for a plan B. You know, it's this idea that we're not getting on with changing our lifestyles and reducing carbon emissions and passing laws and regulations that will change fundamentally what we're putting into the atmosphere. And for that reason, these people are saying we need a plan B. And that's one of the major arguments that is being used in the Royal Society report, as well as by a bunch of right-wing think tanks like Bjorn Lomborg's group, the Copenhagen Consensus, like the American Enterprise Institute, Heartland Institute, the Cato Institute, all of these groups that have big connections to big oil, historical connections to big oil, and who have in the past been very active in the climate deniers camp. I mean, one of the authors of the report that Lomborg's group just put out is Lee Lane. Well, he was advising George Bush on climate change, and we all know what happened there. So, you know, but the odd thing is that in addition to these sort of extremist right-wing groups who are advocating these kind of technologies and say it's going to be a quick fix and it's going to allow us to keep on living and the environmentalists are all wrong, you now have a fairly significant group of what seem to be more moderate scientists who, in despair of our failure to address global warming at the multilateral level, have begun to advocate these technologies as well. Our view is that that's extremely naive.
Once these genies come out of the bottle, it's going to be pretty hard to control them. I was just reading about a U.S. military research wing, DARPA, held a geoengineering meeting this past spring, and Ken Caldera, who's been a reasonable voice but saying we need a plan B, was trying to, he says, persuade the military not to get into it, because who's going to stop someone from using these techniques to punish another nation, to withdraw their rainfall, to wreck their crops or something like that?
Well, absolutely, and some of the, you know, some of the measures that are being contemplated, we know, will have major impacts on precipitation patterns, and we also know that regional impacts will be different. You can well put sulfates up in the atmosphere over the Arctic and have the actual effects be felt in the heart of Africa, because you can't contain them. And the other thing that's very dangerous that's been part of this whole discussion, I mean, on the one hand, it sounds ever so reasonable to people to, we're just going to do more research. We're just going to, you know, find out if it's possible. And we're just going to engage in little small-scale experimentation. But when you're talking geoengineering, they are, by definition, large-scale technologies. These are not technologies that are employed on the local level at all. And there's universal agreement. The people who oppose Etcetera Group most and who are the strongest advocates of geoengineering would also agree with that, that is, by definition, their large-scale intentional manipulation of the Earth's climate. So you can't really experiment them on a small scale. The moment you're out of the lab and into the ocean or into the skies, you're experimenting on the one Earth that we have. And so we believe there will always be a pressure to go to larger and larger scale. And, I mean, the real problem behind all this is, who's going to make the decisions? Who's going to make the decisions? Who's going to control the technology? There's been very little discussion of geoengineering at the multilateral level. There was a discussion at the Convention on Biological Diversity, and there was one at the London Protocol on dumping in the ocean. But that was just over a very, very specific case of ocean fertilization. And, you know, we got, for example, a moratorium on ocean fertilization adopted at the Convention on Biological Diversity by 191 states in May 2008, and it was subsequently violated. So the moratorium didn't actually have enough teeth to impose its will. And in our view, the discussions about who's going to control the technology, whether or not we would want to ever deploy it, and what kind of regulation it's going to come under, all of that needs to happen before we start allowing these experiments to go ahead.
Well, sure. I mean, who could stop the United States or Russia or any country from launching mirrors into space, thus dimming the Earth for all life, and they could do it unilaterally after some climate disaster?
This is absolutely true. The potential for unilateral deployment is huge. And so there needs to be an international treaty that governs these technologies, would be our view, with real sanctions for those who violate its premises. It's just inconceivable. Not only could the United States or Russia decide to do that, an individual, a very wealthy individual, could actually decide to do this, start messing with the climate.
Wow. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Diana Bronson of the ETC Group. We last talked with ETC about the company Planktos, where an individual named Russ George was selling carbon credits, which were never realized, incidentally, while setting up a ship to dump iron in the ocean, supposed to fertilize an algae bloom and soak up extra carbon. Fortunately, I think, for the oceans, Planktos went broke before it disturbed the sea. But I want to ask you, Diana, are you seeing other companies in the wing hoping to get big government grants to start new climate-busting industries?
Well, I haven't done exhaustive search on that. There are most definitely other ocean fertilization companies, and there are companies just waiting to get a piece of the research money that's going to go ahead. One of the alarming recommendations in the Royal Society report is that there would be a voluntary code of conduct for research scientists from the public and private sector they would adopt this. I mean, it's called a code of practice. So it's got no more legitimacy than a corporate code of practice that would be applied to mining or to any other sector. As we all know, if the companies who are engaged in the practice themselves sit down and write the code, it's not going to be very strong. It's not going to be very binding. It's not going to have any real penalties attached to it. Of course, there are profound connections between the energy industry, the chemical industry, the defense industry, and these geoengineering plans. Just prior to the Royal Society report being released, there's a virtually unknown think tank called NOVIM, based in California, I believe, that issued a report on this sulfates in the stratosphere idea, which they call solar radiation management, or SRM. And that study group was actually convened by the chief scientist of British Petroleum. And they have a research partnership with Princeton to look into some of these technologies. Now, he, Steve Koonin is his name, is now one of Barack Obama's key advisors on energy policy. So, these are very powerful men who move in very small circles and who manage to get their views and their friends' views published in very credible papers, and those ideas then get circulated. Even Lomborg's group, I think met with some senior advisors in the White House last week. Now, of course, the White House can meet with whoever it wants, and it's perfectly normal that they'd be listening to all kinds of ideas. I'm not sure, however, we'd be able to get a hearing with them. There's a real interest in the part of the oil companies to exploit this whole new area, that's for sure.
And the corporate media is just picking right up on it. There's been some grand articles about how all this is going to work, with pictures of the sailboats that will go on forever, unless, of course, we have a little problem. And no questioning, no coming back to another scientist or very seldom saying what are the real risks. So I feel the public isn't being informed. I mean, here are people who are actively discussing making the sky white instead of blue. And I think if we just ask the average person on the street, they haven't been consulted.
No, they haven't been consulted, and generally they don't even know about it. The whole discussion really does take place in quite elite circles. For the most part, it goes on in invitation-only meetings. That's beginning to change because the key scientists that have been involved have realized that that functions to their disadvantage. So they're now on an active campaign to get these ideas mainstream, to get them talked about in the media. And really the launch of the Royal Society report was very, very key in that regard. However, if you look at the media coverage of the Royal Society report in terms of its key messages, it was very, very confused. You had headlines that were completely opposing one to the other. You know, you had, on the one hand, something like Reuters saying, you know, world must plan for climate emergency, and then you had the London Times saying that geoengineering could cause a disaster. So you had completely contradictory headlines coming out of it. And that's largely because of the very careful marketing that went into it, the very careful things that were said. One of the mantras that is always said by the geoengineering lobby is that this should not compete with carbon emission reduction strategies. But it's just so incredibly naive to think that if politicians think they have a solution, a techno fix to climate change that's, you know, going to allow them to get off the hook in Copenhagen, that they're not going to use that and that they're just going to go ahead and reduce their carbon emissions anyways. It's just, you know, really extremely naive to think that that's going to work.
What are your recommendations for governments or for citizens who don't want technologists to change the sky?
Well, I think we really have to work to democratize the debate. So therefore, we have to talk about it. We have to let people know that this is happening. And, of course, anybody can go on our website, and we've got several reports on it, etcetera group.org. That's etcgroup.org. There's not enough discussion, I think, in the environmental movement and in, you know, associated movements about what is going on, which means that, you know, 95% of the talk about it is actually pro-geoengineering talk. We also need to set up some kind of a governance process around it. And in my opinion, that should not be under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, because it would be better to have it in the Commission for Sustainable Development or the Convention on Biological Diversity, or at least jointly with multilateral bodies that have a mandate other than addressing global warming, you know, anybody with an environmental mandate understands the urgency around global warming, but are not ready to, say, sacrifice the ozone layer or our biological diversity or, you know, species or all these other environmental goods that we have in order to bring down the temperature, that would have a more sustainable and holistic way to go about it. So we need to democratize the debate. We need to demand accountability from our governments. And we need to say that there should not be one public cent that goes into further research and experimentation before those discussions are had. And then, if we have an actual governance process that is set up, and that governance process, you know, through democratic means and open discussion in a UN body, decides that we better get to elaborating a plan B, so be it. But it shouldn't happen beforehand.
And I think we should have a lot of nonprofit groups and citizen activism putting the pressure on to bring this issue out. Have we missed something? Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners as we wrap up?
Well, I think maybe just one more point on the Royal Society report, which is related to that last point that you made, is really, you know, the public engagement was very, very poor on this exercise. They had a group of scientists work on this, well, along with a lawyer and one social scientist work on this report for a year, and they never held any public meetings with NGOs or others to gather input from the environmental movement, the indigenous peoples, the developing countries are completely absent from their consideration. So, you know, I think it really just, the results of that report point to the skewed nature of their process. And had they opened it up a bit more, they would have been more open to some of the concerns and perhaps have had a better report overall.
Right. I mean, the commons of the global environment belongs to us all, and I don't mean just people in the first world, but obviously every living human and the animals and the plants. So I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking geoengineering with Diana Bronson of the Etc. Group. You can find them at etcgroup.org. I want to thank you a lot, Diana, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.